I guess the best title to fit it all under would be The Christian and Protest. It'll be concerned with such things as employer-employee relationships, Christian and unions and strikes and demonstrations, protest in general. Now, when we come to this subject, the fact is that we find very little specifically about it in the Bible. You'll find very little about how Christians should behave in relation to certain union problems, for the simple reason that in the Bible times, labour unions as we know them didn't exist. Difficulties concerning how a Christian should behave in a democracy, voting and citizens' rights and all sorts of things like this. You won't find a black and white answer in the Bible about many of these things, because democracies didn't exist in the Bible. In fact, most of the things that you strike in everyday life, you won't find a clear-cut answer in the Bible telling you what to do, what street you should live in, or how you should fix your car, or what sort of wage you should get, and all these sorts of things that bother us, all the everyday issues. But what the Bible does do is to give us teaching that we are supposed to use and apply, we're to use our discernment in finding out how a Christian should act in all these things. So although you'll find nothing specifically in the Bible concerning many of the day-to-day decisions that confront us, we will not find that the Bible is silent on these things. The Bible may not give us the pat answer that we sometimes need, but we will find that the Bible has things to say concerning Christian behavior and Christian attitudes, and we are then to mature as we apply those things to the various situations we happen to find ourselves in. At the outset, let us notice that the Bible is not idealistic. That is, it doesn't say, well, this is the perfect society. What the Bible does is to take any particular situation that exists and tries to make the most of it. Take, for example, the laws given to Israel. Those are not the laws for a perfect society. Rather, they are the laws given to a people who already existed in a certain sort of social condition, and the laws attempted to make some sort of sense out of the whole thing. For example, Moses gave instruction on divorce. It wasn't that Moses approved of divorce, but the conditions in Israel were such that divorce was rampant, and what Moses tried to do was to get some sort of order amid the chaos. So wherever we are, the Bible takes people in that position and seeks to get them to live Christianly or live godly in that position. It doesn't idealize, and Christians aren't to idealize. It's not good enough for Christians to say, oh, if only people followed the good book, it wouldn't be like that. Well, of course it wouldn't be like that if they followed the good book. The point is, most people don't follow the good book. And where do you go from there? Now, that's the situation we're in. It's not good enough to sit back and say, when the Lord returns, all these things will be gone forever. The fact is, the Lord hasn't yet returned. And until he does return, we're going to have this chaos and disorder in the world, and we're going to live in a society whose values are not Christian. Now, how do we live in that situation? In other words, the Bible seeks to give us guidelines concerning behavior within a social order that is already established, without saying whether that social order is good or bad. The society that we live in may not be perfect. In fact, it isn't perfect. There are many things in it which are unchristian and which, as a Christian, we find we have to disagree with. What I want to consider is, how do we behave in these sorts of circumstances? Well, firstly, I think we can say that the Christian is not committed to revolution. But then neither is he committed to simply maintaining the status quo. Let's just go on and never change anything. As it was in the past, so is it now, and so shall it be. The Christian is not always to think that the best course of action is one of direct confrontation. But neither is he to sit back and simply approve of everything that goes on. There must be a balance, and I suggest that the course for the Christian is found somewhere between these two extremes, and sometimes it may involve one or the other. We have to face different situations as they arise. I want to consider, as an Old Testament example, this matter of slavery. Now, all of us would disagree with slavery. We'll agree that it was a great social evil. It is everything that a Christian would disagree with in the way it treats human beings. And yet here you find in the Old Testament that slavery is there, and we get legislation concerning how Hebrew slaves are to be treated. Now, as we look at this, I think what we'll see is that the seeds of revolution are sown there through creating within people a radically different attitude towards slaves. It doesn't meet the system head on. And yet it sows seeds there which in time are going to produce some sort of change. So you have neither an explicit approval of the system, nor do you have a head-on confrontation with the system, but you have something which is going to change the system, hopefully through, first of all, changing the attitudes of people towards this institution. Now, before we look at Exodus chapter 21, listen to this verse from Deuteronomy 23:15. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master. I'll come to that in a moment. Let us now look at Exodus 21. We arrive at a situation here where slaves exist, where the institution of slavery is in operation. The first thing you notice is that the Hebrew law suddenly gives slaves rights. And up until now, no slaves anywhere had any rights. They were chattels, they were things which the master used as he wished. But now you notice that a slave does have rights. The first thing you notice is that a slave can't be held a slave for more than 6 years. Chapter 21, verse 2. So in the seventh year, he always went free. Now immediately, we are working towards a regulation of the slavery and hopefully, eventually, the abolition of it. Slaves in perpetuity were not on as far as the Israelite law was concerned. You read through the next few verses and you find that the female slaves in particular had rights. You can imagine that some of these masters treated their female slaves roughly. They sometimes made them minor wives and then threw them out when they got bored with them or something like this. The female slaves fared worse than the male slaves did. But you'll notice again there's legislation particularly to protect the rights of the females. You come down to verse 16 and you find that people cannot simply make slaves of other people as they wish. Some people may have become slaves because they couldn't pay off their debts and so they sold themselves into slavery as a way of getting through their problems. But you notice in verse 16 that whoever steals a man, whether he sells him or is found in possession of him, shall be put to death. You couldn't kidnap a person and then sell him as a slave. So now we have a blow struck at the marketing in slaves that went on in those days. You come down to verse 20 and you find a slave is protected against unnecessary violence from his master. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, then the master shall be punished. It doesn't say how he's punished, but I would imagine that he forfeited his life because of the life which he had taken. But anyway, he was punished. In other words, he couldn't treat the slave as he wished. Verse 21, but if the slave survives a day or two, then the master is not punished, for the slave is his money. Now that sounds a bit rough when you read it like that and you think, goodness me, what's going on here? What is really happening here is this. As in all systems of justice, if there is an element of doubt, you give the accused the benefit of the doubt. If the master beats his slave and the slave dies immediately, obviously he's died as a result of the beating. If he doesn't die for several days, there's an element of doubt there. Did he die as a result of the beating or were there other factors? And so because of the element of doubt there, the accused is given the benefit of the doubt. But notice, he cannot replace his slave. So the master isn't punished, but on the other hand, he can't replace his slave either. As we'd say in Australian, he's done his dough. He's lost his money. You see, the slave's his money, and he's lost him, and he can't replace him. It goes on down to verse 26 to talk about injury done to slaves. When a man strikes the eye of his slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free for the eye's sake. Now this is serious injury. Well, if he injures the slave severely like that, the slave is given his freedom as compensation. If he knocks out the tooth of a slave, male or female, well then the slave goes free for the tooth's sake. Now here, in these verses that we're reading, we have an advance that has never previously been met in the whole of the ancient world. Slavery is there, it's obviously a great evil, and yet the whole social structure of the nation was such that if you abolished slavery, the whole social structure would have collapsed. And so we attempt to white out the system. You eat away at the roots and eventually it will crumble. That's what's happening here. Legislating within the established order, but in such a way that the seeds of change are sown through radically new attitudes being developed. You come in verse 28 to a very interesting bit about when an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be clear. Here we have something as an acknowledgement of the sanctity of human life. Man was made in the image of God, and an ox which was responsible for a person's death had to be killed. The owner, however, was clear, except in verse 29, if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned and has not kept him in, and then the ox kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and the owner also shall be put to death. He's held responsible. Unless, of course, a ransom is placed on him and he can bail himself out by paying money instead, in verse 30. But in verse 32, the point I want to make is that if the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner of the ox shall give to the master of the slave 30 shekels of silver as the payment of the price of the slave, and once again the ox shall be stoned. The slave's life is of exactly the same quality in God's sight as the free man's life. They're all made in the image of God, and there's no distinction. This again, a radical change from the values that existed in the other parts of the world at that time. The verse I read to you from Deuteronomy, if a slave escapes, you couldn't catch him and send him back to his master to get a reward. Now just think, if a system existed where a slave could escape and get away with it, slavery as an institution was doomed, because runaway slaves could be looking for ways of getting into some other part, and then if they were caught, it was against Hebrew law to send them back. Now these laws I'm talking about here applied only within the nation of Israel. But here we have the start of change, which is eventually going to affect the whole world. There are principles here which we can follow as Christians, and we'll develop these as we go along. And just before we leave the section in Exodus, look at chapter 23, the first few verses. It tells us that you shall not utter a false report, you shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. In verse 2, you shall not follow a multitude to do evil. You shall not follow popular opinion. You shall not be carried along by the crowd. Here again is something very relevant to the godly person's behavior in ungodly society. You don't just get carried along by the mob. You shall not bear false witness in a suit, turning aside after a multitude. Even though the multitude may think a certain thing, that's no reason for you to follow them if it's going to pervert justice. It goes on in verse 3 to say, you shall not be partial to a poor man in his suit. Now there's a natural tendency for us to probably overbalance in favour of the person who is the underdog. If you look at the third world today, you'll find that in the vast majority of cases, the underprivileged person in society, the poor person, the people who make up the bulk of the population, have no way of obtaining elementary justice that we here all take for granted. There's a great prejudice against the lower classes because the upper classes have all the power and all the money and all the influence. Now in our society, where we enjoy a great degree of equality, sometimes the balance seems to tip in the opposite direction, and people tend to overbalance in favour of the underdog, even though it may end up being unjust as far as the more influential person is concerned. This is a sort of reaction against the injustice that is common elsewhere. Now the Hebrew law takes a delightfully exemplary middle course. It says in verse 3, you are not to be partial to the poor man. And in verse 6, it says you are not to be partial against the poor man. You are not to pervert the justice due to the poor. So you don't pervert the justice due to the poor, nor do you pervert the justice that is due to the rich. All people are equal and all have a right to the same standard of justice. A tremendous advance on other societies of that time. And while we're on it, let's look at verses 4 and 5. Because a lot of people have got the idea that the Hebrew law encouraged people to be vindictive, that is to pay back tit for tat. You've done it to me, I'm going to do it back to you. And they think that this is in the Israelite law. Well, it's not. Certainly you get a principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but that's given to magistrates, telling them that the punishment must always be in proportion to the crime. And if a person commits a light crime, you give him a light punishment. If he commits a major crime, you give him a heavy punishment. You don't give a heavy punishment for a minor offence. You don't give a light punishment for a major offence. You give an eye for an eye, a scratch for a scratch, a bruise for a bruise. You don't take a person's eye out because he scratched you. And if a person did take somebody else's eye out, his punishment is not something light, such as a hit on the knuckles. The punishment must always fit the crime. It must be proportionate. Now that's as far as the law is concerned. But in their relationships with each other, the Hebrews were encouraged to have the same principles of behaviour as Christians are told to have. We are to love our neighbours as ourselves. And that teaching which came from Jesus originally came from the law of Moses, from the book of Leviticus of all places. And it says there, love your neighbour as yourself. Now here in Exodus chapter 23, verse 4, if you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall bring it back to him. That's good Christian teaching, isn't it? If you see the ass of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall not leave him with it. You shall help him to lift it up. So there, even in the Hebrew law, people are being encouraged to love their enemies and not to repay evil for evil. Now let us go across to Ephesians chapter 6. When we get across to Ephesians, we find that, again, we have mention here of slavery. In this case, it's more slavery in the Roman Empire, and it's more the Roman type of slavery that is talked about. We are not here concerned so much with the Israelite laws regarding slaves, because Israel as a nation was no longer independent. It was under the overall control of Rome, and slavery was universally practiced right through the Roman Empire. Chapter 6, verse 5, we have mention of how slaves are to behave and of how masters are to behave. The system was still imperfect. Slavery was still a great evil. Once again, we find that the Christian doesn't take on the problem head on, but rather seeks to create different attitudes, which, if followed through, will result eventually in the abolition of slavery. This is well developed in the letter which Paul wrote to Philemon, where Philemon was a master who had slaves. One of those slaves ran away later on, became a Christian and returned home. And Paul was writing to Philemon to give Philemon and the runaway slave Onesimus instruction as to how each should behave towards the other. He changed the attitude of the slave towards the master. He changed the attitude of the master towards the slave. The slave was elevated to the position of an equal with the master. And once you've done that, of course, you've worked further towards the eventual abolition of the system. You've undermined the very thing which makes the system operate. That's the way it is here in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 5. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters. So you may not approve of the system, but you've got to be obedient with fear and trembling in singleness of heart as to Christ. We can apply these teachings also to ourselves, not in the way of eye service as men pleases, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. We just don't do enough to get by, you don't do things grudgingly, but he said you work for your master, even though the system is slavery, you work for your master as if you're working for God. Verse 7, you render service with goodwill as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same again from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. So the principles apply the same to slaves as to free men. They apply the same to us as we work for our employers, that we are to have this attitude of not doing enough simply to get by, but doing things because we're serving God. Now masters also get some instruction in verse 9. You do the same to them and forbear threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him. There's the same principle, there's no partiality with God. So the masters are not to take the law into their own hands and think they can treat their slaves as they like. They're to realize that God is impartial. He's not more kindly disposed towards one group than another. Just because they're masters, it doesn't mean to say that they are more favorable in God's sight than the slaves. God is not partial to one or the other, and we must always remember that. By this we can see some of the principles starting to develop. Now I want to move on now to look at how the Christian might develop some of these basic attitudes and principles. Firstly, let me talk about the Christian and his rights. We hear a lot of talk today about the rights of the citizen. Well, what about the Christian and his rights? I think the operative section is the one you get in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus said, it may have been said in olden times, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Now, as I hinted previously, Jesus here is not contradicting the law of Moses. That instruction, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in the law of Moses, was given for magistrates. It was given for people who were administering the law in their society and who were to make sure that the punishments were in proportion to the crimes which had been committed. That was the basis of Hebrew law, and it's the basis of every law that's worthwhile. It's the basis of the laws in our country. You have a punishment which is in proportion to the crime. What Jesus is saying is that the Christian, in his relationships with other people, is not to carry that same legalistic spirit in his heart. even though that may be the spirit that operates in the law of the land, it is not the spirit that operates in the heart of the Christian in his relationships. We must be prepared to forgive. We must be prepared to return good for evil. Now, the very function of law in our society is to return evil for evil. It is to resist evil. Whereas the Christian, he says, we are rather to be forgiving, and if somebody makes demands of us, we're to go further and do more than was required of us. It's fundamental then to our Christian lives that we are not always to be harping on our rights, standing on our rights, demanding that we deserve this and we deserve that, and it's only fair that we should get this, that and the other thing. The Christian must be prepared to sacrifice his rights for the sake of others. But although we may not stand on our own rights and be prepared to sacrifice our own rights, we are very much to defend the rights of others. This is a Christian responsibility. If you go back to the Old Testament, you'll find it right through the Old Testament. How the godly person was to help defend those who were downtrodden. So the Christian then must be aware of the injustices in society, and he must be prepared to fight these injustices for the sake of those who are downtrodden. Almost every one of the prophets in the Old Testament says something like this, as Isaiah says, "Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow, come to the aid of those who are downtrodden and the victims of injustice in society." And so it goes right through. It's one of the responsibilities which God's people have, not just to sit back and let things drift on. Although we may not defend our own rights, we should be in the forefront of those who are defending the rights of others. You find the same sort of thing in the ministry of Jesus. Most of Jesus' denunciations were reserved for the upper crust people in society. The rich who made themselves wealthy at the expense of the poor, who built themselves flash homes while people round about them were starving. These are the people that Jesus got stuck into. He denounced those who devoured widows' houses, yet for a pretense made long prayers. Rich landlords who exploited the poorer people, got them into debt, and then seized their houses and their property. And yet they went along to the synagogue on the Sabbath and they made long prayers and they sounded very impressive and very godly people. And Jesus denounces them. And so it goes on through the Gospels as Jesus denounces these people. You come to the writers of the New Testament and once again you find this sort of thing. James, for example, condemns the employers who didn't give their employees just wages. You see what he's doing? He's not defending his own rights, but he is defending the rights of these other people who are oppressed. He says, "You people, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, you have kept back by fraud." And these things cry out and God hears. "You have lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and no one resists you because they can't resist you." We have to have great admiration for people like Wilberforce, who came along and really led the fight against slavery. We look back now and we say, you see, it was a Christian that really led the fight for the abolition of slavery. And yet I guess that if Wilberforce was here today and was doing this sort of thing, a lot of good, straight, conservative Christians would probably think he was a bit radical, rocking the boat and not maintaining the status quo and rebelling against authority and doing things like this. It takes a lot of courage to stand up against injustices. And we have nothing but admiration as we can look back to these people in positions of power, Shaftesbury and these folks who fought the system and eventually won. They're heroes now as we look back. If they lived among us today, I just wonder how we'd treat them. But I think what they were doing was thoroughly Christian. They were not standing on their own rights and demanding them, but they were defending the rights of others. Having said all that, let me just point out that there may be the occasion when the Christian does have to stand on his rights. Paul, for example, remember the story in Acts chapter 16, where in Philippi, Paul and Silas were thrown in jail without questioning or trial, and it was very unjust. The city administrators found out the next morning what a blunder they had made, and they snuck around the back door saying, "Well, Paul and Silas, we didn't realize, you know, what was happening, and they're iffing and butting and humming and harring. Would you just like to leave, sort of go out the back door here and walk down the lane and sneak out the city?" And Paul stood in his dig. And he said, "Not in your life. You chaps arrested us. You didn't try us. You didn't listen to us. You just threw us there in jail without even a questioning. And now you come in the back door wanting us to sneak out there and save face for you characters. not on your nelly. You come and take us right out in front in the public square in front of all the people. It made the magistrates eat a bit of humble pie, and it also vindicated Paul and Silas in the eyes of the proud. And then later on, when Paul had been the victim of much injustice, finally he appealed to Caesar. That was his right. Now he had for 2 years suffered every sort of injustice imaginable. Nobody had been able to accuse him of wrongdoing, and yet he was kept locked up in jail simply to satisfy certain influential persons in society. In the end, he had had enough, and he appealed to Caesar. So there are cases where the Christian may stand on his rights for the sake of the vindication of the gospel. But when it comes to his own personal pride or progress or wealth or prosperity, whatever, he must be prepared to forego those rights. But at the same time, he must always defend the rights of others. We should be talking not so much about the Christian and his rights, but the Christian and his duties. It's our responsibilities that we should be more concerned with, our responsibilities to others. Generally speaking, we might say that it's not the duty of the Christian church to Christianize the social order. In other words, we're not like a communist system like Karl Marx, who said we're going to change society and we're going to eliminate all the evils in society. And then when you've eliminated the evils in society, people will be better. The Christian comes the other way around. The basic Christian aim is to preach the gospel, to make disciples of Jesus Christ, to plant churches, and then to promote within the lives of the members of those churches standards of behavior which are in keeping with their Christian profession. So the basic aim of Christianity is not the Christianization of the social order, but the Christian influence in the social order will be one of the fruits which will result from the Christianity which transforms people's lives. So the Christian then is not to be passive on social issues. He's not to be negative on social issues. And unfortunately, that's what happens very often. The Christian sits back and he says nothing, he does nothing. Christians too often are known for the things they don't believe in. Very rarely do people really know the positive things that Christians do believe in. And so the attitude that is built up among the populace is that Christians are very negative people, and they just don't accept anything. We are told in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 11, that we are to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. But it then goes on to say, but rather we must expose them. It's not good enough simply to refrain from these things. The Christians must also be concerned with exposing them, expressing disapproval of them. And that is part, again, of our Christian duty. Well, we've talked about a whole lot of basic principles and considerations of various types. Let us now try to summarize what we might say should be a Christian attitude towards all these issues. Don't think that somehow I or anybody else is going to come up with some pat statement whereby the Christian is told you must do this or you must not do that. It doesn't work that way. We have to apply these Christian principles to all the different sets of circumstances we find ourselves in. Very often there is no easy answer, and we're going to go through a lot of soul-searching when in certain situations we're trying to find out what we should do. Well, I hope in some of these things we've talked about, we're seeing how Christianity should operate. All right, I've already said that we don't aim for head-on confrontation, nor do we sit back and simply accept things as they are. We should not be absorbed with defending our own rights all the time, but we must be concerned with defending the rights of others. We must be prepared to suffer injustice ourselves, but we must get up and speak when other people suffer injustice. We must promote justice on their behalf. I can't imagine a Christian willingly doing anything that's going to inflict suffering upon the innocent. When it comes to the sorts of things that happen with strikes and turmoil and protests and demonstrations, often it's the innocent that are the most hurt. And the people who really are perpetrating these evils don't really get hurt very much at all. The Christian must carry his protest to the right person. I don't think a Christian can ever hold the innocent to ransom. I don't think the Christian should ever resort to blackmail as a means of getting his own way, even if it is on behalf of other people. There are legitimate means, and I think we should use all the means available to us to correct the wrongs which exist in our society. The wrongs are there, and they're on both sides. It's not good enough simply to blame the unions all the time. sometimes the management is equally to blame or more to blame. What happens in Christians is that they polarise. They say, well, because I'm a Labour voter, I'm always on the side of the unions, or because I'm a Liberal voter, I'm always against the unions, and they seem to be so blind to the issues that are at stake. I think as Christians we have to look at these things and realise that the whole thing is imperfect, and we've got to be swayed not by political affiliations, but we've got to be persuaded by our Christian convictions concerning the right approach to be taken. Now, there are many legitimate means that we can use to correct some of these wrongs. The Christian should be most concerned about these things. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." If we really hunger and thirst for righteousness, we should be the first to be concerned with correcting some of the injustices that exist. But what we have to do is distinguish between the things which we are pursuing because we believe they are morally right, and the things which we are pursuing simply because we're greedy. The heart of man is deceitful above all things. And sometimes it's very easy for us to fool ourselves and think that we're pursuing some great principle, when actually it's greed and the desire for more which is simply driving us on. We've got to learn to distinguish these things and to be honest with ourselves, and not to be swayed by the mob, whether the mob is right-wing or whether the mob is left-wing. The Christian has to be prepared to sit down and look at these things and find out what his attitude should be. There are many ways we can voice our objections. We can voice our objections to people in authority. We can voice our objections to the government. We can write letters to the ministers. We see legislation we don't agree with. We can ring up our local member. We can go to the manager if we see injustice in the workshop. There are many courses of action open to us where legitimately and honourably as Christians we can voice our protest and our disagreement, and we can seek to make our influence felt. Sometimes we voice our protest against those who are in authority. Sometimes we voice our protest against those who rebel against authority and who want to throw the whole system overboard. And a Christian is not to follow blindly here, but is to examine all these cases that come before him. And let us realise that we are all partly responsible for the ills in our society. Let us not get self-righteous over all this and think that we Christians are perfect and everybody out there, all these non-Christian people, are all sinners. We're all, in some way, responsible for the general mess that our society's in. Maybe only in a very small way, but we're all contributing to the common wrongs of our society, the things we complain about and the things which create decadence in our society. Every time we buy something that we don't need, or buy something on impulse or unthinkingly, we're contributing to the horrible materialism and the filthy consumerism that is making our society more decadent every year. Every time we create unnecessary noise through radio or a motor car or any other noise-producing device you can think of, we are contributing to the overall ill of the noise nuisance in our society. Every time we litter the place, we're contributing to the pollution. Every time we chop down trees or create a fire that's not necessary, we're contributing towards the things that are leading to the deterioration of the environment. These, you might say, are very small things, but I'm just pointing them out because all of us, in some way, are part of a society, and we all make these contributions for better or for worse. Let us realise these things before we get too self-righteous in our condemnation of others. We must realise also that there are some things in society that we are pretty well powerless to change. Supposing you're in a factory and the whole factory goes on strike and you don't think it's a just strike at all. You don't want to go on strike, and a lot of other people may not want to go on strike, but you're either outvoted or bludgeoned into going on strike. And you say, what can I do about it? Well, frankly, there's nothing you can do about it if it's a whole factory and you're the only one that wants to work and nobody else wants to work. The factory's not going to run with one person, so you really have no choice. You've simply got to go out. But you can voice your objection. There are people who are pulling the strings around the place. It's a free society. We can all speak. We can all get on the telephone. We can all go and talk to somebody. We can all write letters. And even if we are forced to do something that we prefer not to do, at least we can voice our objection to it. There may be things that happen in the government. They legislate for casinos. And I say, well, I don't believe in casinos. I'm powerless to stop them. But at least I can get on the phone and I can ring up my local member, or I can sit down and I can write a letter to the minister in charge of that and voice my objection. So that even when these things happen and we find ourselves outmaneuvered or forced into situations that we don't agree with, at least we can declare our Christian position. And in this way, I think we are going to have more of an impact than we think. The silent majority people talk about. Well, unfortunately, Christians are too much and too often the silent majority. And I think if we spoke up a bit more often, we might be able to do something about getting better principles of operation in our society. I hope I've given you enough material to realise that every case must be examined on its merits. And so I've got no pat answer for you, as usual. Because the Bible is not a book of pat answers. It's a book which wants to mould our thinking and change us as people so that no matter where we find ourselves, we can look at the issues that confront us and decide what would be the Christian thing to do here and then follow it through. And above all, we must remember that all the action that we take, all our behaviour, is going to in some way reflect upon Jesus Christ. That's why it is that we are told in the Bible that whatever we do and whatever we say, all our words, all our actions, we must do these things primarily for the glory of God. Negatively, in 1 Timothy 6:1, Paul says, "Don't do anything which is going to cause other people to speak evil of the name of God and his doctrine." That's negatively. Positively, Peter tells us that we are to maintain our Christian character and conduct, even though sometimes it may mean that people will abuse us and call us wrong names. But he says you maintain your principle so that even when they do adopt these attitudes towards you, your right behaviour in the end might silence them. And the end result, he says, will be that honour is brought to the name of our God.